tuning in to the seventh and final show in a mini-series on the books from the Chronicles of Darnia. I'm the producer and main host for the program, William O'Flaherty. As you might have guessed, the main focus today is on The Last Battle, the final book in the Narnia series. The special guest who will be introduced in a moment was only available by phone, so you will notice a slight difference in his audio quality. However, at the time of the recording, there was problems with Skype, and I had to record my co-host's comments on the last half of the general discussion later. This may not be as noticeable to you, but it did mean we weren't able to interact as much with the other shows. That said, this final episode for this mini-series is longer, and I did wait until the end to give you more details about the special guest. I have with me two co-hosts to share this experience. Let me first welcome back Paul Martin from NarniaFans.com.
Thank you for having me again. This is great.
Next is our resident female C.S. Lewis expert who specializes in Lewis's views on women, among other things, Dr. Crystal Hurd. Welcome back.
Great to be back, William.
Then for this final show on The Last Battle, I contacted my friend Kevin Belmonte, who is an award-winning author and historian. While he doesn't specialize in C.S. Lewis, he is clearly a specialist in one of Lewis's major influences, G.K. Chesterton. He's written or edited three books on Chesterton and is a big fan of the Narnia books. Welcome, Kevin, to our special series on the Chronicles of Narnia books.
Thanks, William.
Our first segment, as always in this mini-series, is the story behind the story. Usually I have our guests do this one, but because Kevin's specialty is not Lewis, I'll tackle this portion and have Kevin share something else in a few minutes. Paul Ford notes in his Companion to Narnia that the last battle came about from the, quote, third burst of Narnian creativity. Continuing the quote, he says, the final impulse saw the silver chair, the last battle, and the magician's nephew finished in that order. It was from the summer of 1950 to the spring of 1953 that this burst occurred. While the magician's nephew was begun before the last battle, he didn't complete the magician's nephew until after taking a break from it and starting and finishing the last battle. This story, along with the magician's nephew, had a different publisher than the other books. The first five were published by Geoffrey Bless, but the last battle and the magician's nephew was published by the Bodley Head. They were the ones who released Lewis's science fiction series. Other possible book titles considered for The Last Battle were The Last King of Narnia and, alternatively, Night Falls on Narnia. If you were living around the time the books came out in the 1950s, you had to wait only 10 months from The Magician's Nephew to read The Last Battle. This is not the shortest time between, it's the second one. The previous two books were released 9 months apart. This is the only book not dedicated to anyone. And while not really a fact behind the story, it's worth noting that The Last Battle won the Carnegie Medal from the Library Association in the UK. Later, I'll have Kevin provide some details about his books on G.K. Chesterton and another recent release. But for now, Kevin, could you tell us how you got interested in Narnia and why The Last Battle is one of your favorites from the series?
I've been reading Lewis, well, since I was 12 years old, so it's been a good long time. But I want to acknowledge debt of gratitude to my friend in sixth grade who first told me about the Narnia books. Her name was Elizabeth Perry, and she was not a Christian at that time and never became one, so far as I know. But she told me that I absolutely had to read these books. She loved them, and she'd show them to me in class, and I had never heard of the Narnia books. And so she kept, in a good way, nudging me to want to read them. And I remember so well that I finally decided to take her up on it and went to the local library, and all the books were out, which immediately caught my eye. Somebody must have really liked those books. We had the little one-room schoolhouse near where I grew up in southern New Hampshire, and it was a very small library, but they had the Narnia books, and they were all gone. So I called Elizabeth, and she said, well, come on over, you can get my copy. So I hopped on my Schwinn bicycle and rode over there, and I can still remember she brought me into the house and went to go get her book, and As I remember, she took me up over the stairs, and there in the hallway, there was a great big pile of clothes, and underneath the pile of clothes was her copy, I think it was of Prince Caspian. And it was, I had actually the book in front of me, I wanted to jog my memory, it was the Collier paperback edition of Narnia Chronicles. And I don't have the same books, of course, that Elizabeth had, but I have the same edition, and that reminds me of my first introduction to the Narnia books. And, you know, Elizabeth, God really used her, though I'm sure she never would have looked at it that way. But that planted a seed of interest. I read Prince Caspian, read all the others as she finished with them and let me borrow them. And for the first time, I really began to have a longing for heaven, wanted to believe that Narnia was real. So all kinds of good things flowed from that. And I like to think of it as a touch of grace coming into my life. It wasn't long after that I came to Christ, and the Narnia books had a great deal to do with that, so I owe a great debt to my friend from sixth grade. I've often thought that one of the things that's really drawn me into The Last Battle is that all the earlier books in the Narnian Chronicles point in their several ways to the end chapters of The Last Battle, and by that I mean to the hope of entering into the Narnia that lasts forever. So if we think of the Narnia that was being a Shadowland, and I think there's a great deal of truth in this, and all the best things about the adventures and experiences that unfolded in the earlier books and The Last Battle itself pointed ultimately to Aslan's country, where faithful ones find the Narnia that lasts forever and much else besides. And when I was thinking about that, I was thinking about what Jill and the unicorn, Jewel, say to one another as they walk along. And Jill says, "Our world is going to have an end someday. Perhaps this one won't. Well, Jewel, wouldn't it be lovely if Narnia just went on and on, like what you said it has been?" "Nay, sister," answered Jewel, "all worlds draw to an end, except Aslan's own country." That's just one of my favorite passages that kind of captures what I'm pointing to here.
Next up, we have, as always, we have Dr. Crystal Hurd. She's going to do a short summary of The Last Battle. If for some reason you've not read the book and don't wish to have a summary about it, or if you have and you don't wish to be reminded, whichever the case, then just jump ahead about 3 or 4 minutes to the next section. But Crystal, before you give that summary, go ahead and give us a thumbnail sketch about what people can find when they visit your website, CrystalHurd.com.
Thank you, William. CrystalHurd.com is spelled CrystalHurd.com. Has a lot of neat, just different things on Lewis, and also do some different book reviews there, as well as I do some blogging at All Nine Muses and Islands of Joy. So there's a lot of neat stuff on there that you can go and see, read about, and just catch up on the news. And now here is the short summary for The Last Battle. This final installment begins during the reign of King Tyrion. The kingdom has been peaceful, but the king and a centaur named Runewit experience strange signs, which they believe could reveal an evil present in Narnia. Readers then meet a tyrannical ape named Shift, who takes advantage of an ignorant donkey named Puzzle. Shift and Puzzle find a lion's skin, so Shift perpetrates a fraud, claiming that his friend Puzzle in the lion's skin is actually Aslan. Under the ruling of this fictitious lion, Shift declares that the Narnian animals begin working for the Calormenes to cut down the dryads. King Tyrion, with Jewel the unicorn, suspects something wicked. Tyrion and Jewel discover that Shift tells the Narnians that he is Aslan's spokesman. In fact, he informs the Narnians that Aslan and Tash are actually the same entity. The creature is later caught Tashlan. Tyrion confronts Shift about his falsehoods and is eventually captured and tied to a tree. He begins to pray for assistance. He sees a vision of Narnian veterans Diggory, Polly, Jill, Eustace, Lucy, Edmund, and Peter. Eventually, Jill and Eustace show up to rescue Tyrion. Tyrion dresses up as a Calormene to rescue Jewel. Jill sneaks off to the stable where the supposed Aslan resides and discovers that it is not Aslan, but a simple donkey in a lion's skin. She brings Puzzle back with her to present him to her companions. Soon after, the group frees the dwarves from Calormene rule. Tyrion enthusiastically tells the dwarves that this angry Aslan is actually a fabrication and that he serves the real Aslan. The dwarves are not convinced. However, one dwarf named Poggin joins the group to unite against Shift. Shift is assisted by a sly cat named Ginger. Ginger creates stories to mislead Narnians. For example, Ginger tells the others that Tyrion's disappearance comes not from his escaping the Calamines, but that Aslan ate Tyrion after he cursed Aslan's name. In the meanwhile, the group is in the tower for the night. During a discussion the following day, a dark figure appears with the body of a man, the head of a bird, and a curved beak. This ominous figure swarming overhead is identified as Tash. Faced with the decision to reveal Puzzle to the Narnians or to unite with Runewit to gather an army, the crew decides to find Runewit. However, solemn news arrives through Farsight the Eagle that Cara Paravel has fallen to the Calamine army and Runewit was killed in the attack. Left with no other option, they then decide to reveal the farce to the Narnians at a meeting on Stable Hill. After meeting there, Ginger the cat agrees to enter the stable, but leaves quickly in great fear. A Calamine named Emeth goes next, and just a moment later, a dark figure is discarded from the stable door. The man is clearly dead, but does not actually resemble Emeth. The group now approaches to reveal the fraud, and Shift is thrown into the stable while the stable emits a blinding light, and the earth rumbles. The Narnian dogs join Tyrion's army along with several other animals, but many of the animals are still too frightened to react. Tyrion seizes Rishta Tarkon, the Calamine captain, who cries for Tash. Tash appears and attacks Rishta, then King Peter appears and banishes Tash. All seven of the kings and queens from Tyrion's vision have returned to assist him. All of a sudden, the party finds themselves in a green field and eats rich fruits. After eating, Susan's absence is explained, that she no longer believed in Narnia. Peter and Edmund reveal that in their world, they were waiting on a train platform when the train derailed. There was a loud roar, and Peter remembers that his pain disappeared. Diggory and Polly were aboard the train when it crashed, and presume themselves to be dead in the real world. Lucy recalls what had happened from inside of the stable. A Calamine came through the door and stood with his weapon raised. Ginger came in and exited quickly in fear after seeing Tash. The second Calamine who enters, Emeth, kills the first and throws him out of the door. The dwarves are present but believe that they still reside in a dark stable, not in the open fields that the others see. At long last, Aslan appears. He informs Lucy that he cannot save the dwarves as they have made a firm decision to proceed in disbelief. Aslan then shouts, "Time!" loudly three times, and the Great Father Time awakens. Stars begin to fall and then take the forms of people. Many gather at the door. Those who do not follow Aslan fade into his shadow. Then a great flood consumes the land. Father Time crushes the sun in his fist and the world goes dark. They all journey further into Aslan's country and meet all the old characters who have died or crossed into the land, like Reepa Cheep and Dawn Treader, which includes Fledge, King Caspian, Glimfeather, Puddleglum, King Rillian, Kor of Arkenland, Truffle Hunter, and Mr. Tumnus, among others. Aslan claims that the children, Peter, Edmund, and Lucy, have all died in a train accident, but this is now the morning, a new dawn.
Now it's time to discuss the favorite characters from The Last Battle. Paul Martin from NarniaFans.com will lead us in this. Paul, but before you do that, give us a brief summary about what people can find on NarniaFans.com.
NarniaFans.com is the world's largest Narnia fan community on the internet. And you can find everything from movie information to the music that was written, inspired by, or about some of the books or films in the Chronicles of Narnia, and dive in deeper with a community that spans about 10 years of life on the internet. And going into the favorite characters, we'll talk about our favorite characters from The Last Battle, maybe two or three, and why they're your favorite character. And we'll start with our special guest tonight, Kevin.
Hi, thanks, Paul. I'm going to cheat a little and pick two and talk about them. Two that might be obvious to a lot of people, but they're just real favorites for me, King Tyrion and Jewel the Unicorn. And I think that their friendship, their relationship is very special. It's full of courage, full of loyalty. There's so much wisdom that's expressed in the words they say, the actions they take. And then if I could expand the circle a little more widely to include Jill and Eustace, and then, as I mentioned a bit ago, Pog and the Dwarf, they make sort of an unlikely haphazard company. They come together as circumstances bring them together, but they come together in a really special way and do what can be done in the face of a very dark and uncertain time to try and defend the things that are worth fighting for, and there's just something very winsome about that for me.
All right, moving on to Dr. Crystal Hurd, your two to three favorite characters and why.
Well, I do love unicorns, but I'm actually going to pick Puzzle this time. I think Puzzle is, he sort of represents this tame, lovely spirit. Unfortunately, Shift takes advantage and exploits his industrious attitude. He kind of reminds me of Boxer from Animal Farm, but he's just this, you know, ignorant, and ignorant meaning lack of knowledge, donkey that just works really hard to try to please people, and unfortunately Shift exploits that. But I think just because his heart is in a good place, and he joins, you know, he joins the group eventually, and they embrace him, I think just because of his heart, I really like that character.
Excellent. And moving on to William.
For me, so some of the ones that are already mentioned, they did stand out as well. This Last King, Trillian, stood out. I liked especially, kind of when I was reviewing it, based on something that was mentioned last week when we had a discussion on the Magician's Nephew and how the first king was picked, not because of his, you know, his more obvious great leadership skill, but because of his humility. And we see this characteristic stand out within this final king in Narnia. So that was one of the key reasons why I liked him. And then Puzzle was someone that stand out as well, as is noted in the excellent resource, the companion to Narnia by Paul Ford. He notes how he's a decent sort of animal, but he does lapse into a habit of letting others do the thinking for him, or he's easily manipulated. But he has an innate goodness in him. Early on, we see his concern for the dead lion, and you know, thought a proper burial should be done. He does get talked into, or talked out of that, and so forth. But there are other things to where he has that innocence would be the word that I might use for him. And then just briefly, I did also like Jewel the unicorn. And, you know, the different personality that's brought through in him.
For me, definitely King Tyrion was my absolute favorite character in it. Just the way that he recognized the need for Aslan and then took it upon himself to call for Aslan to come and help. And then there's that magical moment where he sees, like, most of the kings and queens of Narnia of old and like, all of the children, except Susan, before him. And it's just this wonderful moment that you share with Tyrion, and you're watching it through his eyes. While he doesn't know who they are, I believe he knows that they can help him. And that, just that character's hopefulness and willingness to reach out beyond himself because he's so humble is something that I can definitely relate to, that when you need help, you go for it.
Now it's time for the segment we call Unique to This Story. This is where there's elements that are the most distinctive in regarding this book as opposed to maybe the others. Maybe something, some aspect is brought out in the others, but it's either more so or it's not brought out at all.
One of the really unique things about The Last Battle, at least it seems to me, is it's a dark book in many ways. And I was thinking about that because Doug Gresham, when he introduces the wonderful Focus on the Family theater radio adaptation of the book, talks about, and he says, for in even in the midst of great darkness, light bursts through with hope. And I just really love that line. The characters that we've been talking about as we've gone along here, Tyri and Jewel, Jill and Eustace and Poggin and the others, they have to summon great courage. They remain faithful, though so many turn away and are deceived. There are so many virtues in the book that shine all the brighter because it is a dark time. The world of Narnia is coming to an end, and it's coming to an end through violence and conflict. And when I was thinking about all this, it reminded me of something that C.S. Lewis said about G.K. Chesterton's poem, The Ballad of the White Horse. And here's what Lewis said. But how is it possible not to see that what comes through all this is permanent and dateless? Does not the central theme of the ballad embody the feeling, and the only possible feeling, with which in any age almost defeated men take up such arms as are left to them and win? And whenever I come across that passage, whenever I reread it, I just think that resonates so powerfully with what we see in the last battle. And you hear language very similar to that in the book. King Tyrion says early on in the book, we must go on and take the adventure that comes to us. And to that, Jewel the Unicorn replies, it is the only thing left for us to do, sire. And then, of course, you have a bit of shadowing of the darkness when Jewel says, yes, we have lived too long, and the worst thing in the world has come upon us. And they stood like that for a minute or two, and then went on. And so they faced the danger squarely. They understood what it was. They were saddened that it had come upon them, but though all others fall away, they're going to remain faithful. And you hear other characters that I mentioned. Poggin the Dwarf says, if you can put a dwarfish sword in my fist, I'll gladly strike a blow on the right side before all's done. And then I go more toward the end of the book where Farsight the Eagle brings a message from the dying centaur, Runewit, and Farsight brings these words, remember that all worlds draw to an end, and that noble death is a treasure which no one is too poor to buy. And then after Farsight speaks, Jewel the Unicorn says, it's one of my favorite lines, nothing now remains for us seven but to go back to Stable Hill, proclaim the truth, and take the adventure that Aslan sends us. I wanted to say as well that the Narnia books have always created a great sense of longing in me to know Aslan, to think that there might really be a place like Narnia, and when it comes to the last battle, to wish to be courageous just as Tyrion, Jewel, Jill, Eustace, and Poggin were, and that the Narnia books have this power has always been a great measure for me of Lewis's achievement in writing them. The virtues of courage, fidelity, and a love of the truth, all these things shine.
And now it's time for the segment that's just a general discussion regarding the last battle. Something I had mentioned already that I did in the other programs, and that is, of course, we're obviously not hoping to discuss every aspect possible about the last battle. We could probably spend, you know, 7 episodes on this book alone and not actually do that, but we are trying to encourage you to reread or read this book if you hadn't for some reason. And jumping into this discussion portion, let me mention that one of the things that Kevin has already mentioned, he was noting the Focus on the Family radio drama version, and in that, Douglas Gresham, C.S. Lewis' stepson, he does an introduction and makes various comments, and some of the questions here will make reference to that. In fact, the first one, which we'll have Kevin elaborate on some, is regarding Douglas Gresham underscored the narrative power of the last battle by saying, quote, for even in the midst of great darkness, a light burst through with hope. Then that's the end of the quote there. And then, so many times throughout the last battle, characters display courage in a dark and uncertain time. And Kevin notes that this is one of the greatest things about the last battle. The courage as a virtue shines so strongly like a beacon. So he wants to pitch that out to see what the rest of us think. But first, Kevin, if you could maybe share some additional thoughts.
I've often thought when it comes to what you've just set the table for us there with the quotes from Douglas Gresham, one of the great virtues of all the Narnia books, particularly The Last Battle, is I think it models so many things that we'd love to have young people and those who are young at heart carry with them. You know, books bring lessons to us, whether through fiction or nonfiction, and I just think that one of Lewis's great gifts is to foster a love in his readers of the things that matter most in life. And we've talked a bit about courage and fidelity and a love of the truth. Those things can be hard to appreciate and understand as abstract concepts, but the way that Lewis brings them home to the heart in his writing and so powerfully done in The Last Battle through all the characters that stood fast and remained faithful to Aslan until the end, I know so many readers who've come away from reading the book feeling as though they want to try and live like that in their lives. And I think of Lewis's book, Letters to Children, where young people are writing to him and saying those sorts of things, that reading the books has birthed in them a desire to be good. They've learned to love things like goodness and truth and fidelity, that sort of thing, through the reading of the books. So that's a tremendous achievement for any writer to bring that off, and Lewis carries that through so successfully through all seven of the books.
When I was reading that question, some of the things I was thinking about is in looking at the some other aspects or themes that overlap in terms of the courage in a dark and an uncertain time, and the fact that, you know, at the very end, we didn't put a disclaimer here about spoilers here, but obviously there is death happening at the very end. It's the end of Narnia and so forth, and that Lewis is able to, you know, in addition to that, you know, the courage in the dark and uncertain time, shows that death is not something that has to be feared. And Lewis himself, of course, if for people who aren't aware of his background, his mother died when he was quite young. We talked about that with the magician's nephew. And then at this point, though, his wife had not yet died, but he had other people that was close to him that had died. Charles Williams was a close friend. And in the middle 1940s, he passed away. So we all have a certain fear with death, and Lewis is able to weave in that's something that we don't really have to fear. And then, of course, as Kevin was noting, he shows how the characters are face, you know, the uncertainty and the imminent fact that they could lose this last battle, so to speak. So those are some of the things that I thought about.
As some of you all know, I have a background in leadership, and I think one of the really great things that Lewis illuminates here is that being a leader involves having to make hard decisions, difficult decisions. And you see this throughout this book, people sort of struggling with difficult situations and having to make hard choices and hopefully making right choices. So I think that's another really neat theme that comes out, especially when you're discussing courage and discussing the traits that make people better.
Next here, then, we want to tackle something that for a lot of people reading The Last Battle, or for maybe those who aren't too familiar with it, but they kind of hear about and they go, well, it's kind of on two different ends. One is that there's one character that many people have enjoyed in the Narnia stories, Susan, and she does not advance beyond the Shadowlands. But then there's another character, Emeth, who is serving Tash, and he gets into heaven. So kind of a couple issues here. We'll let Crystal share her thoughts regarding Susan, because that was something that she had composed here. So Crystal, tell us some of your thoughts.
Sure. I've actually been working on my website on a series on Lewis and women, and as a female scholar, I've had a lot of people who are resentful or, you know, very affronted by the fact that Susan does not make it into Narnia. But I believe one of the characters says she's tied up with lipstick and stockings and invitations and all these things that a teenage girl would typically be, you know, would be occupied with. I personally don't see it as a male-female thing at all. I think Susan made a choice, just like every character throughout all of the Chronicles, and she makes a choice that she doesn't want to believe in Narnia anymore. She has been there, she has served as royalty there, but she has declined to continue her belief in that, whether she because she believes it's childish or because she feels, you know, there's something that has replaced that in her life. So I don't really see it as Lewis, I guess, dissing the females in these books, because there are plenty of female characters that are great in these books. Lucy, of course, being one of them. And so I think it really does boil down to a choice. We all have a choice. You know, what do we serve? What is our God? Do we choose something that is ethereal and beyond this world, or do we kind of get stuck in the net of our everyday lives and the things that sort of trip us up? So I think in what Lewis is saying is that at the end of the day, we all have a choice. You know, we can choose to follow through and push through all that struggle and come back to the heart of our belief, or we can decide to discard it and choose something else. So that's why I believe Susan is just sort of a representative of people who have may or may not have had some sort of spiritual, you know, foundation, but have decided to step away from that for some reason or another.
And I didn't cross-reference this, but if I'm not mistaken, and it's okay if we don't have the exact reference, but in one of his letters, Lewis leaves kind of the door open that, you know, saying that it doesn't mean that Susan, you know, can't return to Narnia, so to speak, although this is the end story, so I reference that.
Yeah, he actually tells, I think that was a female correspondent, I'm not 100% sure, but he actually tells the child, he encourages that child to actually write an old, you know, alternate ending where Susan gets in. So he actually encourages the students, okay, the, you know, the student to just write, you know, write her back in, basically.
Okay. Well, now, then on the other end, I'll comment, and then we'll let the others jump in as they want, is in contrast here, we have Emmeth, who was serving Tash, and he has, you know, quite different views, but yet he is a sincere, honest in his service. In fact, Emmeth is the Hebrew word for truth, so he's a truth seeker. And so I don't think Lewis was trying to kick up any controversy, because he's obviously not saying everyone gets into heaven, because we were just hearing from Crystal underscoring the fact that, you know, Susan's not there. And then in the version of what would be a judgment, there are people that don't enter. And then obviously Shift, one of the characters that, you know, deceives Puzzle, he's not there. Ginger the cat. And so, you know, if Lewis was trying to be all inclusive and saying everyone will eventually get to heaven, he would have had these characters somehow make it in. But he clearly did not do that. So that's just what I wanted to add regarding that.
As regards Emmeth and the whole notion of whether everyone gets to go in beyond the Shadowlands to heaven, as it were, I think we do need to be careful of putting words into Lewis's mouth. It's a work of fiction, and to extrapolate things about theology, I think, is kind of risky there. But I did want to say, through the art of imaginary literature, Lewis is telling Emma's story, and as has been pointed out, his name means truth, so he's a truth seeker. And the story of how one truth seeker makes it beyond the Shadowlands is a beautiful story. So it probably seems best to leave it at that.
One of the things that I've always been asked about is Susan and why she never made it into Narnia. And the thing that I always kind of tell people is, you know, while I guess I'm not as forthright as Lewis is on that with having someone invent their own story, but I always kind of tell people that that's kind of Lewis's way of reminding us that faith is a daily choice, and it's something that we have to make every day. And we could, any of us could at any time say, you know what, I'm done with this. And then that we would be in Susan's shoes at that point. But then, like when Lewis told the girl to write her own story about Susan returning, that could be our life as well, where maybe one day we decide not to. The next day, or even it could be years from then, but someday we could return and make that return. But it's a choice that we have to make daily. I mean, faith is active, and it requires us to dig deeper all the time. So that's something that I find very interesting and fascinating, and something that we could go theologically very deep on, but obviously we don't have the time for that on this episode.
So far as the character of Susan's ultimate fate in the last battle, I had a look at what Dr. Paul Ford has written about in his Companion to Narnia, and there were four pages dealing about Susan and her dilemma and the way that she fits into the Narnia books, but I really thought a lot about what he said in one of the footnotes, and he says, regarding Susan, this is not to say, as some critics have maintained, that Susan is, quote, lost forever. It is to be assumed, he writes, that as a woman of 21 who has lost her entire family in a terrible train crash, she'll have a lot to work through. And then Dr. Ford goes on to say, in the process, she might change to become the truly gentle person she has the potential for being. And as I thought about that, I jotted down a few notes. It seems to me that from what Dr. Ford says, one might surmise, though very cautiously, that Susan's path beyond the Shadowlands could be a different one, will be a different one than that of her brothers and sister. We don't know for certain if she ever chooses to walk that path, but it seems Lewis may have left that open as a possibility, and I'd like to think that in the end, by virtue of what Lewis has called elsewhere a severe mercy, the loss of her brother, sister, and friends, that she'll choose a path that will ultimately take her beyond the Shadowlands.
Our next question is one that Kevin composed, and he's noting again from the introduction to the Focus on the Family's radio version of The Last Battle, where Douglas Gresham notes that many critics have observed that The Last Battle may be the best testimony to C.S. Lewis's personal beliefs of all his writings. And so, Kevin, if you could elaborate on that, and we can see if that statement bears weight.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think it's a fascinating question. I guess what I would say by way of response is that, as a rule, we should be very careful about trying to glean someone's personal beliefs from a work of fiction that they've written. But that said, I know that from the time I was a child of 12 and I began reading about Narnia and going beyond the Shadowlands as in The Last Battle, all of that made me long for the good things in Narnia and ultimately heaven itself. And if I remember rightly, Lewis's book, Letters to Children, often reflects his deep sense of gratitude that the Narnia stories might inspire readers in that sort of way. So using things like the letters as they relate to Narnia, I think those can be helpful for us.
I think what's really great about The Last Battle is you have a homecoming scene, and with Lewis, and we've talked about this in previous podcasts, but with Lewis, there's always this sense of longing, of wanting to come home, and so the Last Battle actually illustrates that homecoming. We meet Reepicheep Cheep and Mr. Tumnus. We meet all these characters, and we have this, you know, this celebration of this home, you know, this homecoming. I think that's important. So in a way, Gresham was right, because we actually do see the you know, everything coming to fruition, the consummation of all these journeys and adventures sort of coming to a close here as they cross over from the Shadowlands into Aslan's country.
I really like what's already been said regarding this question, and my only thoughts is actually kind of taking the question in a different way and considering Lewis's personal beliefs and thinking back through, especially at the end when you consider that this story does deal with, you know, an end, and there's a lot of grief issues. And if you know Lewis's background and how he dealt with his mother's death at a young age, and now, while it's true at this point, his wife hadn't died yet when this book was published. She had been dealing with some health issues, and Lewis had dealt with the death of another close personal friend in the 40s. So I think, since especially if you were aware that Surprised by Joy, his autobiography dealing with his spiritual conversion, that out of all that, it shows how Lewis dealt with the fact that, you know, this life is not all there is, and that you can look forward to a life to come, and that he's able to really weave that in a story aimed at children, but yet that speaks to people of all ages.
One thing that I thought of, too, is that he has, like, a group of dwarves that are kind of off to the side and in their own little circle. They're kind of in their own little bubble, kind of stuck. They didn't choose to, like, they didn't choose to believe in Aslan, I guess, before the end came. And so it was like they got stuck in this kind of an odd place between the eternal glory and their own egos. And so they remain forever separate from the eternity that we all want and everything. So that kind of says a bit, I think, about if we have a lot of ego ourselves, then are we ourselves, like in Lewis's eyes, are we ourselves fit for eternity? If we are too stuck on ourselves or too stuck in our own ways and not in the way that God wants us to be, do we put ourselves into that? And is it so, like, cause it's always our choice. I mean, it's a gift, but it's our choice. So is that what Lewis is saying? Is that they've put themselves there.
Next, I want to bring up something that we've talked about in our first show in terms of Lewis's writing and then using, so-called, we'll put the words in quotes, pagan or worldly elements in his story. And in this one of the aspects that stands out to individuals is Runewit, the centaur. Although he's not really a major character, it is a question or concern that some have, and that he reads the stars, or he's a stargazer. It sort of suggests astrology here. So first off, Kevin, here, if you could share some thoughts about these kinds of objections that people raise.
Yeah, I was thinking that Christian folk who might find this sort of thing questionable might want to have a good read through the book of Job. All kinds of things are said about stars there, things that are fantastic or poetic, things that are always filled with a sense of wonder and reverence. In Job chapter 9, for example, God is described as the one who commands the sun and it rises not, and seals up the stars, which alone spreadeth out the heavens and treads upon the ways of the sea, which makes Arcturus, Orion, the Pleiades, and the chambers of the south. So there's a wonderful invocation of star formations and constellations that we know today. Some of them still bear the same names, and that's from the 9th chapter of the book of Job. But I also think a few chapters later in Job 38:7, where we read of how the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Or you can turn over to the Psalms, and in Psalm 147, verse 4, you have a wonderful verse that says of the Lord, He telleth the number of the stars. He calleth them all by their names. Great is our Lord and of great power. His understanding is infinite. And then in one of the minor prophets, Amos chapter 5, verse 8, it says, Seek him that maketh the seven stars and Orion. And of course, we have the words of the Lord Jesus in Luke chapter 21, verses 25 and 26, and this is what the Lord Jesus says, And there shall be signs in the sun, and in the moon, and in the stars, and upon the earth, distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear, and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth. And then last of all, I think supremely of the coming of our Lord Jesus, the birth in the stable, that story in the New Testament where we have the wise men who follow the star to find Jesus. God can use anything to declare his truth, and Scripture describes that wondrous star in miraculous terms because it pointed to Jesus, and that's what miracles by definition do. They tell us something about him, and you had that wonderful verse of Scripture from the Gospel of John, chapter 20, verses 30 and 31, which says, And many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name. So to wrap things up, you know, the star the wise men knew was caught up miraculously with the story of Christ coming, and it pointed to who he was. So I think there's just a wealth of Scripture passages that talk about the stars, and in wonderful and meaningful ways, and they mention the constellations. So Christian folk who might trip up a bit on what Runewood has to say, there are all kinds of wonderful references and rich references in Scripture which I think can help people sort through those kinds of difficulties.
Yeah, the next question is, having achieved a first in philosophy at Oxford, Lewis was well acquainted with the philosophy giants such as Plato and Socrates. It has been noted that The Last Battle contains echoes of Plato's allegory of the cave. This idea claims that the philosopher, in this case the author Lewis, introduces his readers to another level of reality that they perhaps cannot reach. And then Crystal has a question, do you believe Lewis does this in The Last Battle, and if so, how does he do this?
Yes, it does seem that in The Last Battle, Lewis takes a page from Plato, as it were. And I'm thinking here of what the Lord Diggory says in chapter 15. When Aslan said you could never go back to Narnia, he meant the Narnia you were thinking of. But that was not the real Narnia. That had a beginning and an end. It was only a shadow or a copy of the real Narnia, which has always been here and always will be here, just as our own world, England and all, is only a shadow or a copy of something in Aslan's real world. And then a few sentences later, Diggory continues, it's all in Plato, bless me, what do they teach them at these schools? And at that point, everyone laughs because it's an echo, I think, of words that come to us from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe back when everything began. So a wonderful bit of symmetry there in the stories. But yeah, I absolutely do think that in that particular passage, Lewis does take a page from Plato. And it, I was thinking about it before the interview this evening and thinking that for a lot of people, ancient Greek philosophers are, it's a different world. To think about that and to begin to help modern folk get interested in that sort of thing. And I don't know that I've ever come across a more winsome, more compelling kind of introduction to Plato than the way that Lewis touches on this wonderful concept of the Narnia within Narnia, the ideal Narnia, coming to the real Narnia, things being a shadow as a waking life is from a dream. These are fairly abstract, fairly sophisticated concepts, but the way that Lewis talks about them in The Last Battle is just a wonderful way to spark curiosity. I remember thinking when I first read it that if that's the kind of thing that Plato talks about, maybe I ought to take a look at Plato. So Lewis manages to do some really special things there. I mean, he creates a longing for passing beyond the Shadowlands on one level, but then I think he also creates curiosity about what the great philosopher Plato himself said, so that's a pretty neat accomplishment when you think about it.
Just to give you some background on what Plato's cave is, it's basically from philosophical teaching where a group of people are chained to a wall. They're in a cave, and they're chained to the wall, and they're facing the wall. So there's a fire behind them, and basically all they can see, because they are facing the wall, are shadows as people move past the fire behind them. So over time, the people who are chained to the wall come to accept the shadows as reality. The philosopher's role is to make the folks who are chained to the wall aware that those shadows, those echoes, are not reality. Those are just shadows. Those are just images that the fire is helping, you know, to cast on the wall. So what Lewis is doing here is he's showing us that our life, the things that we perceive as our reality, are merely shadows or echoes of something much greater, of a place that we, you know, that the reality that's much greater than us. And so I believe he absolutely does that in The Last Battle. And as Kevin has mentioned, at the very end, they reference what are the kids being taught in school these days, because they haven't learned Plato. And again, they're just sort of illustrating the fact that what is our reality, these shadows that we know is not the whole story. There's a whole greater reality beyond what we know and sense. And so it's really neat how Lewis actually ties in his philosophical teaching into Narnia.
And the only other thing that I would add to what's been mentioned is that for those who are interested in exploring Lewis's background in terms of him and philosophy, that there are two good books. One is simply called C.S. Lewis as Philosopher, with the subtitle of Truth, Goodness, and Beauty. There's actually several editors to that. But then there's another one, C.S. Lewis and Philosophy as a Way of Life, by Dr. Adam Barkman. And I actually did a podcast on my All About Jack regarding the book. And there's some links to some at least one sample chapter. So check in the show notes, and we'll have links to that. There are two phrases repeated in the story, not a tame lion, and further up and further in. How does Lewis succeed in being redundant when writers are told to avoid redundancy?
I've always thought that Lewis had a very charming and a very just dislike for rules of grammar that are pushed to a foolish extreme. He said in a letter to Mary Van Dusen in 1955, "Don't let anyone bully you into avoiding sentences with a preposition at the end. It's an arbitrary rule that most great writers took no notice of. The Authorized Version and Edmund Burke thought a preposition a very good word to end with, so there." And I think if one considers that wonderful passage from one of Lewis's letters, that every sentence in what I just read ends in a preposition. So he's really underlining the idea of rules are meant to be broken so long as you break them for good reasons and you do it in a compelling way. So I've always liked that. And when it comes to repetition, I was thinking that Lewis might have richly enjoyed something the poet Robert Frost once said about his fellow poet, Edwin Arlington Robinson. And Frost said, "I remember the pleasure with which Ezra Pound and I laughed over the fourth use of the word thought in the poem Miniver Cheevy." And the line is, "Miniver thought and thought and thought and thought about it." And Frost goes on to say, "Three thoughts would have been adequate, as the critical praise word then was. There would have been nothing to complain of if it had been left at three. The fourth use of the word thought made the intolerable touch of poetry," which is a wonderful line. And to bring it back round to Lewis, I think that what Lewis understood is something that many great writers have known, that done well, a real sense of poetry can flow from repetition.
Then, Kevin, you submitted this question that makes a good logical ending here. You composed here, "Last of all, that Gresham has said, where the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe give the promise, the last battle sees that promise fulfilled." And so you're wondering if this Moffat, a consummation of all things, did it stand out to the rest of us here? First, let's have you share some additional thoughts about that.
Sure. When I think of the phrase consummation of all things, a bit of a mouthful, I guess an easy way to say it, one of the things that I've always loved about The Last Battle is the reunion at the end. When all the most beloved characters from the books, you just have this wonderful gathering, wonderful reunion, exchanging of old jokes and an embrace from people who haven't seen each other in centuries, just this incredible moment filled with joy, just the realization that here is the goodness and happiness that won't have an end. And I just find that so moving. I can remember reading it as a boy of 12, and I think that was really the capstone for me of my reading of the Narnia books. Heaven drew near when I read those lines at the end of The Last Battle, where everyone is brought together, all the characters from all the previous books, and they had that wonderful moment of reunion, and they meet Aslan at last, and he tells them that none of them will ever be sent away again. It's just very moving, very powerful, and you know, I think about that, to be able to commend the hope of heaven in fiction, in a way, and I know that I'm not alone here, you know. It's almost been 40 years since I first read those lines, those passages from the end of the last battle, and the power and the inspiration that flows from everything Lewis wrote, those things are undiminished. And I thought, you know, what a gift to be able to write about passing beyond the Shadowlands and meeting with all those that you've most cared about and having a wonderful reunion with the great lion Aslan, all those things. To be able to write about that in a way that stays with people for the rest of their lives, it's a very rare and very fine gift. So I think that's the thing that I'm most grateful for about the final chapters, the final passages of the book.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we follow that story of Narnia from its inception. We watch Aslan sing it into existence, and then we watch it crumble at the end. And although reading The Last Battle is tough for me, because a part of me is always sad, you know, when everything starts to crumble and disintegrate, and it's hard to read, but you see how the characters, you know, move on into Aslan's country. And so, absolutely, it's a closure. It's the cycle. We see its beginning and we see its end. And so he does sort of close it out, I believe, in the best way he could.
Definitely resonated with me quite a lot in that it became my favorite of the Chronicles of Narnia books because of all of that. And I remember hearing someone say that they, when their mother was reading them all of the Narnia books, and they got to number 7 and they wouldn't let their mother read them number 7 because then it would be over. And as I first read, reread The Last Battle about 10 years ago, I was rereading it for the first time since middle school. And I got to the end of the book, and I think that if this person wound up reading the book later on, they would have been pleasantly surprised, as the end of it said, you know, it's full of hope. Like, in all of the destruction, it's full of hope in it. And saying, you know, every new adventure was greater than the one before. And it has the sense that not only is the adventure going to continue, but it's going to continue on into infinity, and every adventure will be better. And at the end of it, you're left thinking, you know, I'd love to be part of those adventures, and I'd love to know what they're going to be. But I'm really excited to know that somewhere out there they're having these adventures, you know, in my imagination, you know, these adventures are continuing. And that is something that I think anyone that reads The Last Battle can kind of see. It's kind of a bittersweet end, but the, like, bitter that Narnia is over, but sweet that it, you know, it's continuing in your wildest dreams.
From what you were just saying, Paul, that made me think that there's often talk about great opening lines in books. And I don't know that maybe somewhere there is talk about great ending lines. This being the final book in the entire series, I think it's very well done as a great ending line, as you were quoting part of it. It's actually a compound sentence, as Kevin was noting about how well Lewis could break the rules because he was very familiar with it, and he did it in a creative way, so to speak. I think the closing line, which I'll go ahead and read the full sentence, it says, "All their life in this world and all their adventures in Narnia had only been the cover and the title page. Now at last they were beginning chapter 1 of the great story, which no one on earth has read, which goes on forever, in which every chapter is better than the one before." That is where we ended our discussion of The Last Battle, and it seems like a very appropriate place to have ended. Sadly, however, it also means that it is the end of this mini-series on the Chronicles of Narnia books. I hope you have enjoyed it. Before doing a final wrap-up, let me have Kevin share about the books he has done on G.K. Chesterton, who strongly influenced Lewis.
Well, I might say straight off that my way into Chesterton was through C.S. Lewis. Of course, Lewis writes about Chesterton in several places, in his books and letters, that sort of thing. And The references to Chesterton really caught my eye, and I made a note, several years back to revisit Chesterton. When I was in seminary, grad school, back in the 90s, I remember going down the stacks in the library, and there was literally a 5-foot bookshelf just full of the collected works of G.K. Chesterton. And I think there were some 30-odd volumes at that point. There are more now. But I just remember being tremendously impressed at how much the man had written. And of course, I remembered what Lewis said about him. And that was the little seed that was planted, and it later has borne fruit in 3 books that I've done. One is a literary biography called Defiant Joy, and that came out in 2011. Concurrently, because I found so many quotable things from G.K. Chesterton, I thought to put together a book again, taking my cue from Lewis, modeled on the quotable Lewis. We called it the Quotable Chesterton, and I think there are about 850 different quotes, and just as you have with the quotable Lewis, they're all alphabetized according to subject and all traced back to original sources, so that's a ready reference for people who'd like to delve into more or less the entire range of Chesterton's writing, but wouldn't want to spend a small fortune on a whole bunch of books. And then last of all, most recently, just toward the end of last year, I thought, because I've seen so many fine devotionals that draw on Lewis's writings, to my knowledge, that's never been done with Chesterton, to have a year with G.K. Chesterton, as it were. And I thought, gosh, it's high time that someone did that. And when I began to think about it, when I began to pull materials together, I discovered that I seemed to be the first one to have gotten there. So I'm just awfully grateful for that privilege and spending so much time with Chesterton, and then to have friends like Malcolm Guide and Joseph Pierce, who are so wise in the ways of Chesterton, so knowledgeable, say good things about the book. That was just the icing on the cake for me.
Another recent book that Kevin has done is simply called Miraculous. I understand it is a history of sorts of miracles, and Kevin, you even have a chapter about C.S. Lewis's wife, Joy. So tell us more about your book, Miraculous.
It's one of those book projects that an author really hopes to get. My publisher, Thomas Nelson, HarperCollins, came to me with the project, and I do mostly biographies and literary studies, that kind of thing. So when the senior VP for acquisitions came to me through my agent and suggested, he put it to me just like this, how do you feel about writing a book, 100,000 words, a history of miracles from Genesis 1 all the way up to the miracle on the Hudson? And that was it. It was really just something out of the blue, and I was intrigued and asked him to explain it a bit more, and basically I had carte blanche. I could take it from the start and flow of biblical history and narrative all the way up through church history to the present, and I could pick all the representative moments, both from Scripture and the flow of history itself, that I thought might help illustrate the way that God has really sought to draw us to himself through miracles. So it was a wonderful project, an extraordinary journey. I got to keep company with so many great men and women from the Bible, but then from the flow of church history itself. And there is a chapter where C.S. Lewis comes in. I talk about the wonderful instances of grace and the miraculous healing that Joy Lewis knew as she battled cancer. And I thought, so many people know C.S. Lewis's story or things about it from films like The Shadowlands and so many of the fine biographies that have come out. But I really wanted to try and let the ladies take center stage. And I wanted to write about Joy Lewis. I wrote about Corrie ten Boom. I wrote about the early church martyr Perpetua. And then I wrote about a good friend to all of us, Dr. Holly Ordway, and the way that the Lord drew her to himself from a background in atheism. So just so many things that come to mind, but Lewis, of course, wrote the great book on miracles, and I think we used one or two quotes from that for epigraphs, so he was a guiding presence and spirit in the book, but it was an extraordinary journey, and I'm so glad it came to me. I really felt, like the young people say, it was a God thing.
Kevin, thank you very much for being with us on this final podcast talking about The Last Battle.
Thank you. Thank you, William. It's a pleasure to be with you. And thanks very much to the guest host, Crystal and Paul. It's been great to visit with them as well.
Then let me give a final word of thanks to our special co-host. First of all, let me thank Crystal for being with us for this series.
Thank you, William, and thanks, Paul, and thanks to all the guests we've had. It's been an absolutely wonderful experience.
And then, of course, Paul Martin from NarniaFans.com. Thank you for being a part of this experience.
Thank you very much, William, and thanks, Crystal. It was a pleasure getting to know you through this experience as well.
Thanks goes also to you, the listener, for your interest in this podcast on the final book from the series, The Chronicles of Narnia. This is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, the creator of that website and the author of the forthcoming C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters. Learn more about it by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Since recording this episode with Kevin, I had him on the show talking with a guest co-host about a biography he did on D.L. Moody, someone who advocated the principles of mere Christianity before Lewis popularized the expression. You can check the show notes for a link to that interview, along with links to buying any books Kevin mentioned at the end of the program. There's also a link to Crystal's website and NarniaFans.com in those same notes. Plus, if you're not sure how to listen to the other shows in this book-by-book discussion, there are direct links there as well. You can find the show notes either at EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the podcast files are directly hosted. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. Again, that's AllAboutJack.podbean.com. If you go to the other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, you can still get to this podcast. Plus, I have a variety of articles there as well, including a series examining quotations alleged to be from C.S. Lewis. I hope you enjoyed today's show enough to want to share it. Also, feel free to leave comments about the program online and consider listening to other shows. Besides my recent shows related to Narnia, I've done a variety of interviews with authors of books about Lewis, including recently re-releasing an interview with a book mentioned in this show, Lewis and Philosophy as a Way of Life. Older shows include a chat with Wayne Martindale on his book, Beyond the Shadowlands. Again, you can hear my podcast either by going to EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. If you have questions or comments, email them to info@EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, that's info@EssentialCSLewis.com. Finally, did you know that you can help to make sure this podcast is freely available to all? Consider becoming a financial supporter of this podcast to make sure it continues. There is a link in the show notes about this. Contributions can be as little as a dollar a month. There are some great rewards possible, and no long-term commitment is necessary.